This is the Reading Envy Podcast, where we'll have what you're reading. Hello, and welcome to the book-covered back corner of the Reading Envy Pub.
Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jenny. How are you today?
I'm great. You're very alliterative.
Why? Thank you. Well, we're guest-free today.
We are.
We are.
We postponed something that's still coming up, just coming up in the next episode instead. Right. So we've both been reading a lot lately and decided we'd get together and talk about books.
Sounds perfect, which is what we do.
That's what
How
we
about
do.
You go first? What have you been reading?
Well, this past month, I've been on quite a reading spree trying to get some of the Booker long list read.
The Bookers, yep.
Yeah, and so every year these lists come out, and then I race with the judges to try to finish as many of them as I can. I never make it, partly because it would be insane and impossible to read them all, and partly because half of them haven't come out in the United States at that point. So I just picked about half and I read them, and three of them were wonderful. And actually, that's what I'm going to talk about today completely.
Neat.
Because none of them made it into the shortlist, and I wanted to give them a little bit more attention.
Oh, really? Okay.
Because I loved them.
Well, good. What's number one?
The first one is Orfeo by Richard Powers.
Orfeo.
Do you know that author?
No, I don't. I mean, I think I've heard the name.
Yeah.
Orfeo. Okay.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of, I've heard of Richard Powers before. I actually have one of his books on my shelf to read, but I've never cracked it or anything.
Mm-hmm.
He has won some award before, and one of my friends said that he's known as the worst writer in literary circles or something. I don't know where that comes from. Oh. I didn't really find that to be true. But so this book, it's kind of hard to explain, but it's about a composer who is running from the FBI because he accidentally became a bioterrorist.
How do you accidentally become a bioterrorist?
Well, he's been writing music his whole life, mm-hmm. and somehow he starts experimenting with DNA. And because he wants to create something that lasts. In fact, I have a little quote that I wanted to read before I really described it. I wanted music to be the antidote to the familiar. That's how I became a terrorist. And so when the novel opens, there isn't long before he's leaving and running away. And then most of the novel goes back and kind of traces how he got to that point. I don't know. I stayed up really late into the night finishing this novel because I just couldn't put it down. I thought it was really interesting and exciting and not like anything else. And you know how sometimes you read a book where it's like, it connects with a lot of things that are true about you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so like maybe it connected with me more than it might with some people because he's a composer and I was a music major in college, and he goes through this whole thing about how he had his career in music and he felt deep down it should have only been a hobby because he'd also thought about doing chemistry instead in college. And then another thing is he talks a lot about synesthesia, which is when you hear sound and you see color. Well, that's one of the ways it can manifest. And one of the papers I submitted to get into grad school was on that topic.
Oh, how about that?
So, you know, I've done a lot of research on it. Really interesting to me. And then he talks a lot about Bloomington, Indiana, where Indiana University is, which I lived there for a while. So just all those little tiny details, you know, that can happen.
Yeah, lots of little connections. Cool.
Yeah, and there's just musical language throughout the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it's really kind of crazy because for most of the novel, I was thinking that there's no way he's actually a bioterrorist. It's just a misunderstanding.
Okay.
And so, then I'm not sure if that's how I end thinking that or not.
So you said he's, you know, there's chemistry in there and music. So I was still trying to understand that a little bit. Would first of all, would you call it science fiction?
No.
Not really?
So
whatever he does with chemistry and DNA and music is not some kind of a futuristic effect of some type? Or
I guess I'm not sure if it's possible or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seemed very present day. It seemed like it could be happening right now, where he'd been purchasing things off the internet that were easy to find. They're biological matter. It's the same kind of thing that can get people into trouble with by creating viruses. You know, all those pieces that are not in themselves bad, just like when you make meth, right?
Right, right.
You buy fertilizer, which people
which
buy fertilizer.
Which is why I can't buy my allergy medicine over the counter.
Right, and so it doesn't seem unrealistic. I mean, possibly creating DNA that is the same pattern as music or somehow represents music may be a stretch, but I don't really know.
So what was his purpose? Was he trying to create like a life form based on something musical?
Well, he's getting older,
uh-huh.
and I think he wanted to kind of leave a legacy, and he wasn't sure that music had really done that. His musical career hadn't necessarily been that successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, he'd had some pieces performed, but nothing to great acclaim or anything.
Okay.
So it was kind of like, well, if I can't do that, maybe I can do it this other way.
Yeah. Well, cool.
Yeah.
All right.
It's a really interesting book.
that really sounds interesting. And yeah, you know, just generally on the bookers, you know, with all the ones that you've read, how many of them would you say have like science fiction and fantasy elements? I'm just curious.
It's really rare.
It is rare. Okay.
Yeah. In fact, one of the books that made it into the shortlist, which I've read and enjoyed, it's the Karen Joy Fowler one. I'm not going to remember the name of it off the top of my head. I read what the judges said about it and why they included it. Mm-hmm. And they were like, it's so fresh. Nothing like this has ever been done before. And I kind of felt like that's because you don't read science fiction.
Yeah. I mean, I've done that sometimes where you read a mainstream book and you're like, wow, you know, there's a book in science fiction from the 50s that talked about this. And,
right.
And, you know, people yeah, in the promote- mainstream are thinking, wow, this is really innovative and wonderful.
Yeah. I wish more people that read science fiction, read literary fiction and vice versa. Mm. I think there's a lot to be gained from both sides.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have some books to talk about?
Yes, I do. I do. The first book is, I don't know if I need to do a disclaimer at all. I've met the guy who wrote this book several times, and I like him a lot. His name is Dr. Eric Swedin, Swedin. And he is often at the local conventions that I go to. You know, I go to a convention, well, two conventions now that are local. Every year I go down to them. One is called LTUE, which is Life, the Universe, and Everything. And the other one's called Conduit. And Dr. Swedin, Eric Swedin, is at most of those conferences. And whenever he's there, I always look to see what panels he's on. And if I can get to him, I always get to him because he is endlessly interesting. So he wrote a novel. He's written several novels. But in this novel, well, I guess I'm going to have to consult with you on whether I'd call it a novel or not. But I'll explain that in a second. But what it is, it's called When Angels Wept. The subtitle is called A What If History of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I should also note that this won the Sidewise Award. The Sidewise Award is an award given for alternate history. They give an award for a short form and a long form at Worldcon, but it's not part of the Hugo ceremony. And I'm not sure how winners are selected. I don't think that people vote. I'm not really sure how that happens. But it's just called the Sidewise Award for Alternate History. And this book won it in 2010. So what this book, claims to be a history book written by a historian in Australia, long years after the, Cuban Missile Crisis, which went, not as it went in real life. And it's written as a history book. So, I just remember in the first, two or three chapters, one of the things it talks about is that, the United States, oh, I should mention, first of all, just to place it in history, the Cuban Missile Crisis was a thing that lasted for about 2 weeks. I think 13 days is the famous, there's a movie called 13 Days or something like that. In 1962, it was October 14th through the 28th of 1962. And the crisis was between the United States and Russia. Russia had placed nuclear missiles in Cuba. And the United States found out about it and said, this will not stand. And the author, Dr. Swedeen, says that, you know, not as part of a fictional account, but he said this is probably the most important event in the 20th century because of how close we came to a nuclear war. We came very, 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 very close. It's like, you know, if a decision had been made differently, if something had gone differently, this could have ended up very, very bad, which is what occurs in the book. In the book, it ended up very, very bad. And the guy, again, who's purporting to write the book is in Australia, which was not part of the Cuban Missile Crisis and didn't end up having any nuclear bombs detonated in it.
So when you say the guy that purports to write the book, you mean the narrator or the actual author?
The author. It's like, so Eric Swedeen wrote the book, right? But there's a fictional character who's writing the book as a historian.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
But it's a history book. So, you know, a typical paragraph. Two men confronted the most important moral choices ever made. Nikita Khrushchev and John F. Kennedy. What sort of men were they? How did they make their decisions? Through their lives, we can also see how the United States and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics reached the point of confrontation over Cuba. So that's... It reads like a history book. And then the first three chapters, three or four chapters, are history that really occurred, and it is as it occurred. And then the place where he diverges is there was a flight over Cuba that took some photographs, and that's mm-hmm. what alerted the United States to what was happening. He says, what if that got delayed and didn't happen exactly when it happened, so that when the United States found out about it, the missile silos were not under construction, but they were complete. And that is his turning point in history. And
so after that, does it include anything that's historical, or is it
sure.
from that point on?
It's... Yeah. So here's what he says in the author's afterword. He says, the history related in this book through chapter 4 is true, with obvious exceptions such as speculation about whether the Apollo program would have succeeded. So the historian wondered if Apollo would have worked, you know, because mm-hmm. the Apollo was underway, but, you know, we hadn't been to the moon yet.
Right.
From chapter 5, which is titled The U-2 Flight That Never Happened, The Crisis Begins, through later chapters, the narrative is informed by actual plans and capabilities, but the history is fictional. So, yeah, it's a fascinating read. I just thought it was really terrific. There's a moment in the, you know, one of the things that makes it personal to me, like the previous book was personal to you, was that my father was at sea during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He was in the Naval Reserves.
Wow.
And he was on a boat that was taking troops to Germany. So it's something that they regularly did. They, you know, bring troops there and take some home. And it was, it was a cruise, you know, mm-hmm. something in the school he was in. So while they were at sea, they were notified. They were asked, are there any Naval Reserve officers on your ship? You know, and they had to send in my dad's name. And so they were at the ready to be diverted from on the way to Germany to go to Cuba. But
wow.
they were never requested to do that. And there's a place in this book where something horrible happens to the collecting force that's going to invade Cuba. And my dad would have been in that group. So when you thought, wow, you know, that moment, you know, whoever's decision is made, you know, you know, I wouldn't have been here had that happened, had it happened that way. And it just seemed as if it was a decision or two away from that. It just makes you think about, or made me think about, the world and people making decisions and how, you know, the president of the United States has such incredible power. And if Kennedy had made different decisions, how different the world would have been right now. Right. If Khrushchev, who was irrational a lot of the time, if he didn't make some rational choices once things got really heated, how bad it could have been. It's not comforting to think that you know, we're on this thread of these people's personalities that you know, run our countries. You know what right. I mean? It just makes it, you know, it's so important that we select the right people. And even then, it's just like, wow, you know, just a decision away. Really tough to think about.
This came up, CNN did a series about the 60s that I watched because I feel like I don't know a lot about the 60s. Uh-huh. And an entire episode was about Kennedy.
Was it?
And I feel like this came up, like if Nixon had won, what would this crisis have been like? You know, would it have escalated faster, or, you know, would it have even gotten to that point? It was fascinating to think about.
Yeah. And it's fascinating. You know, we hear today, you know, all of the Sunday journalists and everything who seem to know everything after things happen. Right. You know, and I say that facetiously just because, you know, hindsight is 20/20, but, you know, they're always saying, well, you know, if this president was in there, then these people wouldn't dare do that. And, you know, the thing is, we really have no idea. Mm. We really have no clue, but it's just the fact to me that for one thing, that we as a human race made nuclear weapons and we made a hell of a lot of them, and that we have people that are in charge of those things. and we still do. You know, it's not something that we think about all the time anymore, but when they were brand new, man, they were on people's minds. And, heck, you know, we used one too in Japan, and, man, it's just hard to believe, but this book really brought it home. It really brings it home.
And he wrote it in 2010, right? So it's pretty recent.
Yeah. It's very
kind of
recent.
A recent exploration of that.
Yeah.
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 Hmm.
Yeah. Looks so good. I highly recommend it.
I was looking through the list of other books that have won that prize because, you know, me and awards.
Yeah.
and actually, most of them I don't even recognize. There's a few familiar authors, but the majority of them, I don't know them. It must be more on the historian side, maybe.
Yeah,
there's The Plot Against America by Philip Roth. I know that one. And The Yiddish Policeman's Union, which I own but haven't read. And then the others, really... those are the only two I recognize. Yeah,
Charles Stross won it for The Merchant Princes, Volume 1 through 3. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not his
Mary
usual
Mary Gentle
thing.
Ash's Secret History I've heard of.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Stephen Fry won one for a book called Making History.
Yeah, Harry there's Turtledove, all types of authors.
Harry Turtledove's the guy I think of. Stephen Baxter, Voyage. I really like that one. I've read that one. But, yeah. Yeah. J.L. Sprague DeCamp wins a Special Achievement Award for Lest Darkness Fall, which is one of the most famous alternate history books.
I've never heard of it.
Well, I've got it.
Apparently, this is a category I don't read, so it's good to learn about.
Yeah. Neat. Yeah. But yeah, Harry Turtledove, I think, is who people think of most often. That's really his main thing, is alternate history. I read one... World War II started up and aliens arrived. So right as World War II was starting to, you know, really get hot, aliens invade. And now Winston Churchill and Adolf Hitler and Roosevelt are now on the same side.
Huh.
Yeah, it's a series of books. I think it's called World War Tilting the Balance or something like that.
It'll be an interesting one.
Yeah. So what's next up for you?
Well, this is The Blazing World by Siri Hustvedt. And I should say that this author and the previous author are both Americans, and this is the first year the Booker Prize has included American authors. So, good job, Americans. So this is a complicated one to read and explain. It's about an artist named Harriet Burden, and it's written kind of as a compilation of artifacts after her death. So it includes her journals and interviews with family members and critical reviews of art exhibits, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Because during her life, she claimed that she had had some art that she had done, and then two men she paid to do her art because she wanted to prove that the art world took men more seriously than women. So that in itself is an interesting concept. I really struggled with deciding what I thought about this book, but then I kept thinking about it and thinking about it. So I decided that's probably a good sign, because I really dislike the main character. She's rude and obnoxious, and I don't know that you can actually believe what she says in her journals, because she's very intentional about everything. You might even call it manipulative. And I kind of thought she might have written her journals to match her story. And you just don't know. I mean, yeah. You kind of ask yourself that throughout the whole thing. But it's just so complex. Even in her journals, they change styles, and she's writing about philosophers, and she treats science fiction authors as philosophers, which was interesting because Werner Vinge, is that mm-hmm. how we say his name, is like on the same par as Kierkegaard, which was different. I've never seen them handled that same way. Yeah. I mean, have you ever seen the kind of mockumentary or documentary, The Stories We Tell?
The Stories We Tell. No.
Yeah. Uh-oh. It's kind of recent. Mm-hmm. It reminded me of that. That one's about a woman who dies, and her youngest daughter interviews all of her friends and all of her brothers and sisters to try to find out the true story of who her father is. Uh-huh. But it's the same kind of thing. It's like, you know, the truth changes depending on who you ask, you know, especially when it's about a person. What's the truth about a person? Can anyone ever really know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's really fascinating to read, and it goes back and forth with all these different things. And I enjoyed it.
Well, that's good.
It made me think a lot.
Yeah, I like those books that make you think about it. I, you know, there are books that I finish and I'm like, I don't think I like that very much. But a week later, I'm still thinking about it. And I think that's right. Good. I think it's a very good thing.
It is. Yeah.
And I think that that points to a quality in that book.
Yeah. And I don't really have an excerpt to read because everything was so different from each other in mm-hmm. you know, all the parts.
Yeah.
So nothing is really very representative.
Right, right. Well, fascinating.
That's really all I have to say about it. But okay. Yeah, it was a really good read, but it didn't make the short list. That's okay.
So,
I mean,
go ahead. Sorry.
Well, in the end, I was thinking about it later, and I felt like it's so well written, and it's so intellectual, but it kind of comes across as cold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's like nothing to connect to in it the way that the previous book could.
Yeah, yeah. Right. The previous book was personal to you, too.
Yeah.
So, do you think Americans being included in the Booker Prize is a good thing?
Well, it sure makes the list longer. I just can't think of all the things that the judges have to read to pick nominees to begin with. I mean, it's so long. I kind of always enjoyed using it as like, I don't know, an excuse to read things that weren't published in the United States, because the United States has the majority of the publishing workforce, really. You know, it's just like the music industry. It seems like that's kind of the central industry is the American one. But I mean, I think it's fair. Now it's just the entire former British Empire that gets included.
The entire former British Empire, right?
Yeah.
What about the National Book Award? Is that American only? Sounds like it is. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And then Canada has the Giller Prize. Which I at least pay attention to who wins it. They just put out their long list, and the National Book Award just put out their long list. It would be too much to read all of those. But
I imagine other countries have them as well that aren't English speaking.
Yeah, the more I read like World Lit, the more I find out that there are these other awards And they're a good way to like introduce yourself to literature of those areas if you don't know it.
Yeah.
It's definitely not everything. There's an Asian Pacific Award that's been pretty helpful in that arena.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
And by the way, Orfeo is on the long list for the National Book Award.
So. Oh, okay, cool. So Richard Powers is also American.
Yeah.
Cool. Because, yeah, I read only Americans. I don't
right.
I don't want these foreigners. I'm kidding. Of course, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. But my next author is American.
Oh, good.
I'm going to talk a little bit about H.P. Lovecraft. It's getting, it's fall, and I'm starting to get into the horror fiction, which I do every fall. I'm reading Salem's Lot. But what I reread recently was H.P. Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness. Have you heard of that one? That's probably, yeah, I thought so. It's probably his most famous work. So Lovecraft, this book, it's a novella, was published in 1936 in Astounding Stories magazine. It says February through April. So it's at least two, you know, was serialized at least, I'm guessing it was three pieces cause it is kind of long. Excuse me. But as I was reading this book this time, I started to see a lot of connections in other things like Alien, the movie called Alien. I don't know if you've seen that.
I have not.
there's another one for your list. But that's a horror movie. That's a science fiction horror movie.
Oh, hooray.
Yeah. And then Arthur C. Clarke. You know, I'm starting to wonder, you know, Arthur C. Clarke is British, but I'm wondering if he was influenced a little bit by Lovecraft, because there's a story of his called The Star. I guess I should explain the story first, and then I can tell you why I think that they're connected. But also, Rendezvous with Rama has a very similar structure to this. Made me think of that. And then the other thing that, for some reason, I hadn't read At the Mountains of Madness for a while, and he actually mentions twice in here, at least twice, Edgar Allan Poe's Arthur Gordon Pym. So this is somewhat of a sequel to that book, but it says that in Arthur Gordon Pym, which is what some people call the first detective novel, there's a part of it that happens in Antarctica. And in Antarctica, there was some type of a stream or something that Lovecraft mentions twice. He says that Arthur Gordon Pym must have actually seen what these guys are seeing. So he's saying, yeah, that was factual, which is kind of neat, you know, that Poe and H.P. Lovecraft have a connection, because Poe comes before Lovecraft, 50 years before or something like that. But At the Mountains of Madness is about this guy. The very first line is, "I am forced into speech because men of science have refused to follow my advice without knowing why." So he's forced to write down this account of what happened when they went on an Antarctic expedition and what they found. Because scientists are insisting on going back down to Antarctica to explore. And he's like, "You guys are going to, you know, be dead." And I haven't written down the whole thing because I don't want anyone to be curious, you know, so it's kind of funny. But yeah, everybody's curious. So they want to go down there. Anyway, it's just one of those qualities I love about Lovecraft. He's always saying stuff like that. So the main character, the guy who's narrating the story, he says, "As a geologist, my object in leading the Miskatonic University expedition was wholly that of securing deep-level specimens of rock and soil from various parts of the Antarctic continent." And there's lots of things like that, lots of details about these scientists. There was four people from the university. There was a biologist, and there was a physicist who was also a meteorologist. And this guy was a geologist, And there was some assistants and graduate students and stuff, all from Miskatonic University. Which, you know, I just love Miskatonic. I've got to get a shirt. I've seen them around. Miskatonic University t-shirt. And I also love in Lovecraft how, you know, he was also a critic, and he did a lot of things where he would read weird literature and talk about it. There's a paragraph here. Danforth was a great reader of bizarre material and had talked a good deal of Poe. I was interested myself because of the Antarctic scene in Poe's only long story, The Disturbing and Enigmatical Arthur Gordon Pym, which I have not read and is now on my list. I want to get that read before October, for the end of October. Mm. So just a quick part of the plot that somebody goes off on their own, you know, with some assistance and things, and they find a bunch of mountains with structures on them. And they've determined that these structures are really, really old, and they used to be under the ocean. And they've been uplifted as Antarctica was lifted up out of the ocean, you know, over millennia. And they find these creatures that are frozen, and they this one person, not the main character, not the narrator, but this one person starts to, you know, dissect them and try and figure out, you know, what they are and everything. You know, they're just so unlike anything that we've ever encountered. And there's two camps set up. One camp where this guy's doing the dissections, and then another camp where this guy is, and most of the other people in the expedition are. And it's probably predictable what happens. You know, those things, once they hit the sunlight, they wake up, and the person doing the dissections and everything disappears. So this guy flies into that area, you know, on an airplane. And I just love, you know, Lovecraft's, how he describes things. It's so dramatic, overly dramatic. Every incident of that 4.5 hour flight, which is the flight that he took to this site, is burned into my recollection because of its crucial position in my life. It marked my loss at the age of 54 of all that peace and balance which the normal mind possesses through its accustomed conception of external nature and nature's laws.
Yikes. So,
yep. So almost the whole novella is this fellow Dyer, which is another interesting point. He's never named in this book. It's just I. And then I found out, or in the footnotes of the edition I was reading, the narrator is identified as Professor William Dyer in another one of Lovecraft's stories called The Shadow Out of Time. So yeah, there's a lot of ties and stuff, but most of the story is these two guys exploring these structures, because they're going in after this guy who disappeared, and they think that he might still be alive because he's genuinely disappeared. So they're going through these catacombs and describing, you know, page after page of descriptions of what's on the walls and how, you know, there are corridors that go up and down, and there are ramps, and there is all this stuff, and the artwork, and it's just description of them walking through this stuff, and things are getting more and more tense because you feel like they're getting closer and closer to something, which they are, you know. But obviously they get away because he's telling this from his comfort at home, right? Which is why Rendezvous with Rama stuck in my head for the first time when I was reading this, because that's what Rendezvous with Rama is. Rendezvous with Rama by Arthur C. Clarke is about a alien spacecraft that is detected coming towards Earth, and they send an expedition to it, and these people go in there, and the whole book is them exploring this seemingly empty alien spacecraft. While the whole time you're a little bit tense thinking something's going to come out and, you know, say hello anytime. You know, Rendezvous with Rama is not a horror novel, but it's like the same.
But it could easily be, right?
Yeah, it could easily be.
Little twist.
Exactly. So, but the the structure seems the same to me, you know. Yeah. And in the star, which is one of my favorite science fiction short stories, there's a person describing a Pluto-like planet, you know, a planet that's really far away from the star that has an entire civilization's records on it. It's like this entire civilization knew that they were going to die because they knew that their star was going to go nova. So they put all of their records on Pluto. It would be like us knowing that the sun was going to go, and we collected everything that we could collect and we sent it to Pluto because we knew that we had no chance. And so again, it's like an archaeology, you know, an astronomical archaeology or a cosmological archaeology, I guess. So
I was kind of smiling because the Southern Reach trilogy by Jeff Vandermeer.
Yeah.
There's an Area X expedition and it sends four women scientists into that area. And how you were cool listing the four. Yeah. Just kind
are
of
they, are
like
they all, do they have the same responsibilities?
Psychologist, botanist. I'm not going to remember all of them, but they all have different jobs. Wow. Kind of like,
see, your that's, little, that's really cool. So yeah. What is the Southern Reach trilogy? Just a quick.
Well, all three books came out this year, and they're about an area probably kind of in Florida where people have been disappearing and things have been happening too. And the area, the government's controlling it. I mean, it's kind of like you just don't know what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. And we and know so Jeff first, Vandermeer has read Lovecraft.
Yeah.
I mean,
I'm sure he doesn't want to. People, I don't know, authors get sensitive about, you know, well, they must have just gotten it from that.
No. You know, often it's like a homage or something. Yeah. You know, see, I think that a lot of authors put things in there to be discovered that are like, oh, wow, that's this, you know, that's, you know, that's a good thing. It's not like, you know, they're ripping anything off. It's just, it's like an Easter egg almost.
It
adds depth to a person who catches that, but it doesn't matter if you catch it or not. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
It seems like that kind of thing.
Right.
And plus, you know, I know your story. Is it a story, novel, novella, you said? Novella.
Yeah.
The Lovecraft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a novella.
That's an Antarctica one, but we know that Lovecraft writes about swamps too, so.
Yeah.
He picks the spookiest places.
Yes, we do. Yeah. And Dagon. Yeah, this is funny. You know, I was talking about Dr. Spadine, and at one of these conventions, the Conduit Convention, every year they have a Lovecraft panel, and we've had it so often that they call it the obligatory H.P. Lovecraft panel now. And it's always fun. I mean, it's just an hour of a bunch of people that just love H.P. Lovecraft and talk about it. One year, somebody actually brought a document that had H.P. Lovecraft's writing. You know, Lovecraft was so poor or odd, I guess both, that he would take letters that he received and rather than throw them out or file them or whatever, he would write in the margins a story, you know, on the back and in the margins. He would use every inch of a piece of paper. And so it was funny that this guy found some things on eBay and he bought them, and it turned out it was H.P. Lovecraft's real writing. And so not only did you have some letters that he had received, but you also have his writing on the margins, and it was so cool to see it.
Yeah, it adds to the mystery.
Yeah. He was an odd fella, but the more that I learn about him, the more intrigued I become. I think that that's just probably most people's experience with this guy. And he's published, they've published volumes of his letters too. He wrote letters like crazy. He'd have been good on the internet.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, but if he had done that on the internet, we would have lost them. because they would have been stuck behind a password.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. We probably would have. That's funny. Well, that's all I've got on him, but I read him all the time. Not just October, but it's fall.
It is. Mm-hmm. I love fall.
Me too.
It doesn't necessarily make me want to read scary things, but you know.
Come on.
My last book is The Bone Clocks by David Mitchell.
Hey, I've heard of it.
Yeah, it just came out in September. Well, this is still September. It came out at the beginning of the month. And David Mitchell is one of the authors that I will buy and everything he writes.
He is the Cloud Atlas, right?
He is.
Cool.
Yeah, and this book has some similarities to that. You know, Cloud Atlas is written in a sextet where there are six different novellas and they're embedded in between each other, kind of. Like the first one stops halfway through. Yeah. And so this is actually a sextet too, but it doesn't work the same way where you divide the stories in half. It starts with a girl named Holly in 1984, and she runs away from home in the English countryside. And she discovers that she sees these people, and she can see kind of this other world. And then it kind of goes away again, and then you follow different people through some time, and the time moves forward only, unlike Cloud Atlas. But it was really interesting. It has this whole second storyline of these people called horologists, which have to do with timekeeping and traveling through time. And these people called anchorites, who are the evil people. This is a really hard book to explain. But all the parts are written slightly different. There's a chapter about an author, and in that section, he goes back and forth. The author is talking about himself in third person and as I in the same paragraph all the time.
Oh, wow.
Because he's kind of losing it and kind of seeing himself as a character, I think.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so it's weird because I always liked David Mitchell, and part of what I love is the words that he uses. And since I got to see him speak this past spring, I hear the entire book in his voice. So like there's this one sentence. Oh, I hear the boomy scrape of an airplane, and I hear it. I hear it the way he would say it. So it's kind of funny. But you know, most of it is very heavily set in reality. It's in Cambridge. It's, you know, in a small town in England. It's Sheepshead. And then all of a sudden, you're jumping to the anchorites of the Dusk Chapel of the Blind Cather of the Thomasite Monastery of Saddlehorn Pass. So he kind of goes in and out of reality, which I really like. It reminded me of some of the more recent Murakami books, Haruki Murakami, which I think is a comparison he wouldn't mind. And what else can I say about this one?
I think those are both authors that I need to try. I mean, yeah. Murakami, you've told me about him before. Didn't he write that 1Q84? Is that the same person?
That's the book that reminds me the most of this one, style-wise.
Cool.
Where kind of just like all of a sudden you'll see a kind of a window into something that's not quite real. So, yeah, it's very similar to that. What I love about David Mitchell, too, is, you know, you can read and enjoy the novels on their own. But he intentionally writes all of his novels as part of what he thinks of as an Uber novel. Like one giant, huge novel. And so a lot of times the characters show up again, or the places do, or there's some little details that are repeated. And it's kind of funny because this is true even about his novel, The 10,000 Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, or it might just be 1,000 Autumns. Yeah. But that's about 17th century Japan when they traded with the Dutch. And there's still some crossover, amazingly. And that's just like straight historical fiction. Huh. So there are people online that have made charts and graphs.
Really? Oh, that's neat.
Yeah. And it makes me want to go back and read all of them again, which I might do.
Wow, that's something else.
Yeah. I really enjoyed this one. So it's very complex and... Oh, here's another quote from the book because it makes me laugh. A book can't be half fantasy any more than a woman can be half pregnant, but yet this book manages to be half fantasy. So there you go.
Half fantasy. Yeah. Wow, that's cool. Yeah, half fantasy with a twist of lemon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
I like it. Well, if I was going to try a David Mitchell, what would you suggest? Would this be the one?
I would probably start with Cloud Atlas because I still think that Cloud Atlas is the greatest masterpiece.
Really?
I mean, he writes in six completely different styles and manages to pull it off. Wow. And then they're all kind of related to each other. Now, if you've seen the movie, I think the movie exaggerates the thing they have in common way too much.
Yeah, and I have not seen the movie. I purposely avoided it because, oh, it's not very good. I avoided it not because I didn't think it was going to be good. I just thought I wanted to read it first.
You do.
I think you may have said that to me a while back or something. Yeah. But I heeded the advice.
It really is a fantastic novel.
So it is a swing and a miss of a movie, huh?
Yeah. I mean, there's some good parts and some not so great parts. I just didn't think that what the director's thought was the most important part was the most important part to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they use the same actors in multiple roles to kind of really drive that point home. Mm. And their makeup is just too obvious. And you're sitting there thinking about their wigs and their makeup instead of paying attention to the movie. You know,
yeah.
But Jim Broadbent is amazing, and Tom Hanks is on it, and he pulls off the Hawaiian post-apocalyptic slang pretty well. But really, I think like the audiobook is really good.
Oh, who reads that?
It's a bunch of people,
really,
to kind of match the different parts.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so I think it had at least 6 different narrators.
Does it read like a bunch of short stories, or you know, I'm just trying to understand what you mean. You know, is there like a narrator that, well, I guess it's this style that he writes in. Does it repeat throughout the book, or is it like a section and then a section and then a section?
There are basically, 6 stories. However, the first story opens and closes the book.
Interesting. Okay.
So they're like, I don't know what you would call them. They're all bookends to each other. So the central story doesn't get split.
Okay. Fascinating. All right.
Yeah. Well,
I definitely need to put that on my list. I'm very interested.
Yeah, and it's neat how he's being so intentional about all these little things you can find. And I only noticed 2 of the characters in this novel that came from other things, and there's probably 12 in here. So
see, that's cool. It gives you a reason to read it again.
Absolutely.
Not that you have to have one, but...
No, but I do own it now, along with all of his others.
Very cool. Very cool.
This is probably my favorite book I've read in the last few months. So,
cool.
Great.
Sounds good.
And how about you?
Well, my very last one. We went to Comic-Con in, and I say we, I mean me and my daughter and my son and some friends went to Comic-Con just a few weeks ago. It was in Salt Lake City. And I got to meet there someone who I really, really, really like. His name is Dave Kellett. And he does a comic online that I've been reading since I found out it existed. It's called Sheldon. And the website is sheldoncomics.com. So I bought the book that I bought is the third one of his that I have. And it's called 62% More Awesome. I felt that would be really appropriate to mention here because he often does a comic with a literary twist to it. So every now and then you'll see one that like Dune will show up or something. You know, he's always doing something. In fact, I think that he's got one of his books. I should have looked it up before here, but I think he's got one of his books is a kind of a literary or a literature subset of his comic strips. And I can't remember. Here's the store right here. Call it up here. Hopefully it's just...
I found one called Literature Unsuccessfully Competing Against TV Since 1953.
That's the one. Literature, yes. Unsuccessfully Competing Against TV Since 1953. That's right. So I just love this comic. It's about Sheldon is a boy, probably, I don't know, 8 years old or something. He lives with his grandpa. I have no idea where his parents are, but he lives with his grandpa, and he invented something that speeds up the internet. So he's insanely rich. The boy's insanely rich. So that really doesn't come into play all that often. You know, there was a series of strips where he was... at his company. Every now and then he shows up at his company, he has to do something. But most of the time it's him and his grandpa, but he did download a bunch of information into a duck, and the duck is named Arthur, and he can talk. after he had a bunch of stuff downloaded into his brain. So, if you have a pug, there is the volume 2 I have here in front of me is called The Good, the Bad, and the Pugly. He has the best pug comic strips. He's got to have a pug of his own. And he also has one called Coffee, It's What's for Dinner. He often does coffee related strips as well.
Sounds like something I need to start reading.
it's fantastic. Every day in the morning, it's one of the first things I do on the internet is read the latest one.
So it's something he's still working on.
Yeah. Yep. It's a daily comic strip.
Did you get it signed when you were there?
I sure did. Not only did he sign it, but he drew in it.
I thought that might be true.
Yeah. So I have a picture of Sheldon here. He's going, woo. Yeah, but it was so cool.
So is it 62% more awesome?
It is 62% more awesome. Yeah. Yeah. So I have Pure Ducky Goodness, The Good, the Bad, and the Pugly, and now I have 62% more awesome, which I bought, directly from him. And my daughter bought a book from him, too, called How to Draw Web Comics, I think is what it's called. Let me see if that's here, cool. too. But it was a really substantial book about how to publish a web comic. And he's one of the authors. He's not the sole author. But it was a really impressive book. I liked it. I flipped through it. Learned quite a bit. There's probably a lot of tips in there for anybody who's doing anything on the internet, really. But anyway, a heck of a lot of fun. SheldonComics.com. Yep. And that's all I've got this week.
Okay. Well, I have one more thing, if you don't mind.
I don't mind at all.
I just wanted to mention that this week is Banned Books Week.
Banned Books Week. Books about bands.
There's so many of them. but the American Library Association sponsors this week every year from their Office for Intellectual Freedom, and because they track books that are banned, books that are questioned, or challenged, I guess is the word that they use. So that's the books that people file complaints about that have to be reviewed by a board or a library director, or however they do it in that particular library. So I was going through some of the various lists they have, because you can look at lists by year or list by decade. But they had come across the Radcliffe top 100 novels of the 20th century, and they went through and marked which of those were on the banned book list, and almost half. Half of the 100 novels, the top 100 novels. So that was really interesting to go through, like 1984, Of Mice and Men, Brave New World, Clockwork Orange.
Well, we don't want people reading those. We don't want people reading those.
Yeah, so I'm challenging myself to read at least one banned book this week, and I've actually started by reading a book about a banned book, because there's an entire book written about Ulysses by James Joyce, and it's on the 6th most banned.
I thought that was banned because it was hard to read.
Well, you would think, but no, it's actually because it's profane and maybe pornographic even. And so I read the book and I wasn't really bothered by anything specifically, although yes, it's a big challenge, but reading about the history of that, and it just kind of becomes the history of censorship in general during that time. Because it was around when they were trying to keep anarchists out of the country and communists out of the country and anyone that was going to do something that diverted from, the main message. So there were all these independent magazines that were being censored. And back then, the post office actually was the arm of the law for censorship cases, which I thought was really interesting.
That is interesting.
So I've started by reading that, but I want to try to read one of the books on this list that I haven't read yet. Like, I haven't ever read Lolita, and that'd be a good one to probably pick up and read.
So is that one of the 100 best novels too?
Yeah, it is. So it'd be kind of like a checking it off of two lists.
There you go.
Yeah.
A twofer.
Yeah, and there's two Kurt Vonnegut novels on here, and neither of them are the two that I've read. So he's another good one.
Yeah, I like him.
Yeah.
And I don't necessarily. Something that he said that always stuck with me. It had something to do. I think it was Breakfast of Champions. Yeah, I could be wrong, but I think it was Breakfast of Champions. And he, it was a point that was made to me. You know, so he made this point to me when I was very impressionable, and it stuck with me that it had something to do with chicken soup, and chicken soup could be used in this novel as a terrorist weapon somehow. So rather than go after those people, they banned chicken soup so no one can have it. And I just thought that was profound to me, because it was, you know, clearly the wrong focus.
Right.
Which is why I can complain about not being able to buy my allergy medicine.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they're throwing out the baby with bathwater. Yeah,
we'll just go ahead and ban that for everybody, because some people use it for this.
Right.
Yeah. I think you can say that with almost everything. You know, you can buy taco shells, and some people could use those for evil.
Right.
I'm sure.
And I guess it's just who gets to decide what you get to read, you know?
Yeah, as far as reading goes, you know, it's like a two-edged sword. You know, I don't like people banning books, and I don't like people making people read that stuff that they don't want to. It's like both, you know?
I once went to a challenge at a public library in Indiana where I lived, where they had to have a public hearing as part of their process. And the parent was trying to get a book not just like moved into the adult section, but removed from the entire collection. So that was really interesting. And there were very emotional speeches on both sides.
I imagine. Yeah.
And I gave a speech myself because I could. It was really interesting, though, to see the process happen. Mm-hmm. Thank you for listening to the Reading Envy podcast. You can find us at readingenvy.com.